What's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. I have James Whatley all the way from just a little outside of London. Today we're going to talk about gaming. We're going to talk about life as a strategist. James is currently Chief Strategy Officer at Diva. Focuses a lot on gaming, at least on the internet, but probably with his clients as well. Having spent years working at places like Digitas and Ogilvy and 1000 Heads, James Whatley, welcome to Sweathead. How are you?
I'm very good. I guess everybody says this, but I'm really happy to be here. So thank you for having me on.
Not everybody says that, but I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Gaming. What's up with that, James?
It's massive and amazing and everybody does it and they don't know they do it. And I love it. I've got the best job in the world.
There you go. That was the biggest question I'm going to ask you all interview. You actually did a BTEC, which I don't know what that is, but you did a BTEC in performing arts. What was that all about?
Wow, you're taking me right back. Crumbs. So when I left school, I thought I wanted to be an actor. And then when I really got into it, so BTEC is, I don't know, like a shit A-level. Went through a phase of people going, I don't think this is actually worth anything, this course that I've done. But I did a BTEC in performing arts. And then in the process of doing that, realized how much I actually loved directing and dance. So in a long time, I was going to be a dancer. But then the directorial piece of it, putting stuff together, orchestrating it. I had a moment a few years later when I was working startup side, I was still doing a bit of amateur dramatics. My chief marketing officer came to see me in a play. And she said, she rang me up the following weekend and was like, I understand you now. I get you now. I said, what do you mean? She's like, when you go on stage, are you scared? I was like, no. So what do you mean, no? I was like, well, I get the anxiety of like, I'm going up a roller coaster and the energy that I'm going to have on the roller coaster is great and I'm going to have the best time. And if you're in the room when I'm having that best time, then amazing. And she's like, you arrogant sod. I said, no. I mean, like, I've worked really hard to do it and I'm not afraid of it. Mm. And she goes, and that's what I figured out about you, James. You're not afraid of anything. You're not afraid of being wrong. You're not afraid of getting it wrong because of your training in acting. That's why you can stand in our VC offices in Mayfair and tell our investors that they're wrong, which I had done the week before. And I was like, yeah, because when you're doing theatre, you're trained to just ask all the stupid questions and get it wrong in rehearsal.
Yeah.
That thing kind of stayed with me and helps me post-rationalize a lot of what I do today, actually.
For what it's worth, I relate to that, right? So when you're teaching or you're on stage giving a talk and that's how you come to life, that's you coming to life. Mm-hmm. It's not you being obnoxious or arrogant. And sure, you could say, well, it's arrogant to think you have a point of view to share with anybody. But what if being in that situation is how you feel most yourself? That's where I connect to it. The challenge with what you just said is we're going to talk about this. And maybe that we get into this before we talk about gaming is you've been experiencing some self-doubt. So you just told us your origin story, which is confident, James. But yeah. As a strategist, also experiencing self-doubt, including today. What happened?
I mean, I can say what day we're recording, right? Today is the 29th of September. We're a few weeks out from the Do Together conference, and I've got to put together a talk. I did the recording last night. I sent it off, and then I woke up this morning and realized I hated every single thing about it. So I sent an email to Dot, and I said, hi, if I hate everything about what I sent you last night, am I allowed to redo it? And she said, yeah, of course. And I was like, thanks so much. Like, she must get this a lot. And so I showed the script that I wrote to my missus. And she's like, what is this? What have you written here? And I said, I just feel like this is what I'm supposed to do. And then we had a really big talk about it because throughout my career, I've had people say to me, ah, oh, James, you're a planner. You need to go and work in the planning department. I get into the planning department. James, you're not a planner. You're a strategist. No, you're not a strategist. And I've had people say to me, like my leaders of my department say to me, the problem with you, James, you're not a strategist. And that on my last day as I've left the business. And so that all came back to me. And I adore Sweathead, right? I love being a part of that community and reading and occasionally lurking, but participating where I can. I love this podcast. And so I built up all this anxiety around, shit, I'm going to be in front of actual proper strategists. I better do actual proper strategy. And so my first video was me being all very like, this is, and my missus was like, who is this person? They've not asked for this pretend strategist. They've asked for you. And I had to pull that apart. I've literally wasted hours on that today and it's been horrendous, but I've got a better version and it has been submitted, but Jesus Christ, no. Oh, ugh, yeah.
How does that calibrate to James on stage with boss saying, you're not scared of anything, you're not scared of being wrong? Same person? We'll talk about the imposter syndrome. I know it comes up a lot and everyone's got it. But the main criteria are that you're objectively a high achiever. And this is from research by Dr. Clance and Dr. Rimes. I'll try to always shout out people that I've read the research of. This is from the 1970s. So you're objectively a high achiever. That's one criteria. Two, they talk about the Superman or Superwoman dynamic or really syndrome, which is where you expect to do really well. And then three, you're waiting to be revealed by an esteemed peer. Now, your story, the one that you had, including the person on your last day at work saying you're not a strategist, I would have rolled up maybe two middle fingers to that person, by the way. That's very English and passive aggressive. And probably they thought about timing it to the minute for at least a month.
Oh, no, I think they probably thought they were trying to help me, which is even worse.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Fair enough. In that case, sorry if you're listening and you're the one who said that to him and you're being nice and trying to support him with his escape parachute. Maybe that's what you were doing. Here's an escape parachute. Grab this. But in a way, you've kind of actually lived through the imposter syndrome where someone who is your revered elder peer has said maybe this isn't for you. But help us understand, because you started off by saying performance helped you become very confident because you just work it out. And now you're saying you're nervous about being revealed as a fake, as an imposter. What happened?
I mean, the timing of this recording today couldn't have been any better, because I've had this real kind of revelation today around, to me, strategy is clarity and pulling apart and interrogating and interrogating and trying to get to the bottom of whatever you can get to the bottom of. And not believing everything you see. And I always talk about going the extra click. What's the one click I'm going to go further than the other person to find the source of that data, and how many people and what countries and so on? That methodology for me has kind of built the foundations of what I do as strategy. You build off that and then you make leaps off that building that you've made, the creative leaps or customer experience leaps, but you build that base to jump from. However high or precarious it is, you know, your choices. But that's been my interpretation of understanding what strategy is, because I've never sat down. I didn't go to ad school. I didn't come in through a grad scheme. I kind of fell into the strategy department because somebody told me I was shit at client service. And the growth that I went through has gone through like, okay, well, I'm doing this right and I'm trusting my instincts. I'm doing this right and I'm trusting my instincts. I'm picking stuff up from peers around me. I'm triangulating like against my peers and my boss and other people in the industry, trying to figure it out. And I don't know if it's a London thing or an advertising thing, the reverence around, oh, but you know, but that's planning. No, that's strategy. I'm like, am I doing that? I don't know if I'm doing that. I'm just going to do this thing.
London has a certain dynamic there. You know where it comes from. And sorry, Aussie in New York that London doesn't want to listen to necessarily about this particular point, but it obviously comes from your class system and the Oxbridge vibe. And you see it on the Twitters, you see it on the LinkedIn. There's this policing about what is, what isn't. Yes, I put stuff out there, but I'm not usually doing it in a super dogmatic way, even if I write in character as a dogmatic character, which is not my thing anyway, but I'm messing with things. London, there are ways to be and ways not to be. It's built into the culture there, right? Which is, in this industry, at least over there, an elite culture. What I love about the US is it is more free-flowing. It is less judgmental, and people like to see an entrepreneur. They like to see people trying to do different things. London's pretty self-policing, I think, and especially within this industry, which is weird. Because isn't this industry supposed to be creative? Now, how are you feeling today? Just from a psychological point of view, how are you going to get yourself into the space to put yourself out there in a way that feels truer to you?
What I did was, so I've done it. It was, I literally did the second recording 2 hours before we jumped on this call. Changed my t-shirt. I had a big old roll neck jumper on. I had a drop sheet behind me. And I was like, "What? Who are you? What are you doing?" And I just thought, it's funny. I did a talk yesterday for a group of people in learning and development, talking about how to use strategy in learning and development. And it was great because you're talking to people who don't know much about what you're talking about, but therefore ask amazing questions and challenging questions. And you get to think on your feet and enjoy that workshop. And I thought, I want to bring that guy back. That guy I was yesterday, I'm going to bring that guy back for the talk I need to do. And I brought him back and I was like, oh yeah. It's nice to be that guy because that guy is me. That's not me pretending to be somebody else who I think strategists are expecting to see, or the person that told me I wasn't a strategist. Their ideal opinion of what a strategist is or what a planner is, I'm not pretending to be that perceived ideal. And I really fell into that trap today because, I mean, this is an explanation, not an excuse, because it's my trap that I built of myself, because I care so much genuinely about the sweathead community. I don't want to turn up and be, who's this guy? What's he talking about? I want to like do it properly. But I had to come to the realization that doing it properly was doing it as myself.
Yeah, it's that one click extra thing that you talked about earlier. So I love public speaking, even though I'm relatively quiet when I'm not in public. And I just think for a lot of strategists, a lot of younger people coming up can really change their careers. And I see a lot of scripts, I see a lot of CVs, and often my main question back to people is like, where are you? Who are you pretending to be? I've spent time with you. I might have been in rooms with you for days, worked with you, and you've disappeared on this piece of paper. So then if you've disappeared on this piece of paper, who are you going to be when you appear in front of a camera? What is that? I often start there. And it's interesting because so many people have to second guess themselves about how to be in this industry. And if you're already thinking about the 50 people you interviewed for a project and the 10 workshops you've got to run in the next month, to then be thinking about how am I going to appear, that must be exhausting.
Completely. And I guess I'm lucky in the, obviously through the theatrical training and I did the speaking circuit when I was in startup land, I've done quite a lot of public speaking and I'm really comfortable on a stage. I trust myself. If I've done my work, if I've done my rehearsals, if I know my slides, if I know my topic, I'm going to be fine. And for some reason, yesterday I couldn't do it and today I cracked it.
Concept for other people thinking about this, and then we'll talk about gaming in a second, is in sports, you hear people talk a lot about pictures or photos or images that sports people have in their mind. So let's say you're talking about football or soccer and someone's going to take a free kick because they've done it thousands, maybe tens of thousands of times. They have certain images in their head. What James was saying about, I want to be that guy, the guy that you saw in your mind who was talking to the clients yesterday, you want to be that guy. That's the image you need. And I think that concept is really, really useful so that as you start to develop a public speaking practice or even just pitching a little bit more, you've got some kind of structure in your head. It's like, no, that's who I want to be. And it might be you, or it could be a combination of three speakers and a stand-up comedian and someone on YouTube that you like. And you put them all together and you're like, that's going to help me focus so I don't have to continually wonder about how I'm turning up.
Can I jump in on that? Because the way I got back to that guy, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier on, I use this all the time and I've used it easily for 20 years. The roller coaster analogy I mentioned before, like before you're about to go on stage, your heart is going nuts. You're tingling. Sometimes you really want to go to the bathroom and you're just like, ah, what's going to happen? And I figured out pretty quickly that that energy feels the same energy as when I'm going up on a roller coaster, the click clack. Now, this only works if you're a roller coaster fan. So if you hate roller coasters, this is not for you and I'm sorry. But I know that I'm strapped in, the energy is building, but when I go over the lip of the roller coaster, I'm going to have such an amazing time. And it's only going to be a few minutes. It could be 15, it could be 45, but in my head, it's a few minutes. But I'm going to have an amazing time. So when that foot goes out on stage, that's me going over the roller coaster and that energy just arrives. And it's controlled. And that's how I get through it. And that's why I love it.
How else does that energy affect you before the day? So for example, these 2 weeks that I'm in right now is probably my busiest in terms of training lots of big companies. And I know my stuff inside and out. I could probably literally stand in a room for 3 days just saying things, which is probably a horrible thing, a horrible way to be, but I love it. Yet I'll wake up at 3 a.m. for weeks. I'll wake up at 3 a.m., fall back asleep, wake up at 5 a.m. I'll be like, oh my God, what do I have to offer this room? What do I have to offer this room? And so I have to talk back to myself. Like, you've got this. You've done this before. You've written a book, by the way. You can always just open up that a book and like just read it out. But like, I really have to steady myself because I get this panic that if I'm lucky, I can turn into joy. The way that I do that, for example, is, and this phrase goes around the internet a little bit, is like, I get to do this. Or I focus, like I went up to do this training the other day down near World Tower in one of the big buildings, level 47, level 43. I almost felt like crying because I was like, oh my God, people are paying me to do what I want to do and I get to feed my family doing that. And so I try to shift the energy, but I have to do it a lot. Like it's not just once. I have to do it repeatedly, possibly for many, many days. Is that at all? Or am I just weird? Weirder.
No, I do. I mean, there's a bit of personal approach to this. You may relate to this as much, and we'll get into the metaverse gaming stuff. There's a metaverse talk that's gone on the internet at the moment. As much as there's one presentation there is a recording of, when I've done that in person, I've changed it slightly. I've changed it slightly for the room. It's kind of a point of pride for me that I never give the same presentation twice, or I try not to, because the room have asked me to be there for a reason. And my first question to anybody who asks me to appear in that room is, what do you want them to take away? how do you want them to feel afterwards? What can I do to make their experience better by being there? And the sense of waking up in the middle of the night means you care. It's the, okay, have I done enough? Of course, you know what you're doing. And it's interesting to me that you talk yourself back. For me, it's a case of going, is there enough that's purposeful and direct for that room?
I get it. It's weird talking about this. It's weird because for me, the writing and the presentations are so personal, even though you're doing them in public. It feels odd to talk about it, but I appreciate it. Let's chat gaming. First of all, as we shift into the second part of the interview, tell us about Diva. What does the agency focus on? What do you do there?
So Diva's been around for about 15 years. I've been at the agency for 7 months. We describe ourselves as a gaming native creative agency. And I would say for the first 10 to 12 of those 15 years, the agency is solely focused on advertising and marketing within the games industry. So making ads for people like Devolver, PlayStation, Activision, Curve, Sega, any games developer, we pretty much probably worked with them over the past 15 years, specializing with developers and publishers. Over the past 3 or 4 years, when like the great acceleration, as Google refers to it, thanks to COVID, we talk about what did COVID get rid of, what did COVID ignore, and what did COVID speed up? COVID sped up global adoption of gaming as a pastime and the understanding of what you can do online together. And so with that comes non-game brand interest in the games category. And part of my joining the agency was to help spin up, build, finesse an offering outside of the games category, as well as introduce strategy as a product and service to our existing clients, but also go, right, brand X, you've never heard of games before. What do you want to know? I mean, the small handful of clients that have walked in through the door this year without pitch, which is amazing, have just come in and said, incumbent agency tried to do this thing. It didn't work. Can you help us? You're the experts. Okay. And the amazing thing about the place is I get to go into the office and say, does anyone know about this game? And a hand will go up. Everyone's played everything.
So broadly speaking, two categories of work that you do. One is helping non-gaming brands get into gaming.
Yeah.
To help them put their brands in front of gamers. And then the second is strategy in general. So brand strategy, creative briefs that might or might not touch anything to do with gaming. Is that right?
No, other way around. Part one is right. Part two is just for gaming brands. I mean, for crying out loud, I lost a pitch about a month ago. First pitch I've lost at the agency. And I still walked out of it feeling okay because A, the work will come back because there's some other work in there that will probably come back to us. And B, I got to play a game that is not coming out till 2024. And there's a bit of me which is like, this is super nerdy and I love it. It's so cool.
Which games do clients want to be in right now?
Well, that's the main question because they come to us and they say, tell us about the gaming landscape. Tell us about gamers. And there's a great quote by, why is her surname going out of my head? Elle McCarthy. She's the VP of brand for Electronic Arts based out of San Francisco. She's an ex-brand planner. I don't know if you know her. She did an interview where she said there's no such thing as a gamer. Gaming, because it's such an intense pastime now, such a popular pastime now, it's lost all meaning. You may as well say, can I speak to millennials? It's the same kind of nothing word.
I feel that point of view has been around for about a decade. Are you saying that's a new point of view that's getting new air again?
As in no such thing as a gamer?
Yeah, I've seen that around for a good decade.
My clients haven't seen that.
I wasn't being difficult. It's just I remember seeing a lot of that framing of gaming when games appeared on phones, but also when Facebook had a lot of those widgets that you could play games in, right?
It's kind of, you still got to do the hard work on the audience set, right? And so brands coming in say, I want to understand gaming. Say, okay, well, here's the landscape. What are you trying to do? Then you start getting into the proper grown-up questions like, okay, are you trying to find new audiences? How do you want to find them? Who are you normally speaking to? Is it a new way of finding an existing audience? Can we go away and find what games they're playing or what platforms you'd find them on? You get into a platform conversation, then a business objective conversation, and then what is it you're actually doing? Is it just a media buy? In which case, speak to our media partners who can sort that out for you. But if you want to do something a bit bigger, a bit different, a bit interesting, then let's have a chat.
Do you have a process with a trademark name?
No. I've just been spinning up the offering. It literally falls into, for non-games brands, it's research and insight, a bit of creative strategy, and then eventually we'll get into production. But the moment it's predominantly research and insight going, we think we've got these assumptions. We say, okay, yes, you're right. They are assumptions. Let's go and have a look at them properly.
If you spend your days trying to get into people's heads, but are interested in strategy classes, books, and events that get into your head, visit sweathead.com. You can pick up the Kickstarter-funded book, Strategy Is Your Words, by me. Find out about our monthly membership, online classes, and the company training that we do. Yes, this was an ad, a gentle, gentle ad. Back to the interview. Can you try to help me understand slightly more specifically some of the main questions that clients bring to you, other than, hey, what's up with gaming? How do we get involved with that? What are some of the questions that they've asked you that have stuck with you where you're like, that's a good question?
Specifically non-gaming clients.
Yeah.
The great question is always, we want to do something in the metaverse. We've had that a couple of times. We've also had, we want to speak to gamers, because it's always the broad stroke question. And then that gets into much richer territories. So there was a client who had a partnership with a football team and came to us to ask about the metaverse. And we said, you've got a partnership with a football team. You could do something in FIFA. Why aren't you doing something in FIFA? And like, oh yeah, we could do that, couldn't we? And it does feel a bit like you're cheating because you feel like you're pointing out the obvious. It feels so much to me like, I mean, I came up into strategy during when social media went from nothing to everything. And so it feels like similar conversations, which is, I've read about this social media thing. How do I get into it?
Okay.
I'm getting the same vibe, which is, I've read about this gaming thing. Like, there was a 2-page spread in the Sunday papers. I feel like our brand is missing out. What should we be doing? It's high level first, but gets detailed quite quickly.
So how can brands get into games? What are the logistics of it? Obviously, some publishers might have sales teams. Some might have self-serve. What are the actual practical ways that someone or a brand can get into a game?
It depends. Of course, it depends. Immediately, you're always going to have games that just fit already straight away, right? So a car brand's going to fit really neatly into a racing game. A sports brand is going to fit really nicely into a sports game. If you've not got a brand that has a natural fit, let's look at your question a different way. You can go, I want to appear in one of the major video game platforms like a Roblox or a Fortnite. That's a partnership play. What are you doing? Are you sponsoring the gear that they're going to wear for DLC? So an example I always come back to is when Marvel's Avengers came out, the video game, they did a partnership with Virgin Media here. And if you're a Virgin Internet customer, you got a free pack of DLC for your Avengers. And frankly, it was a bit rubbish. Like, nobody wanted Captain America in Virgin branded costumes, right? It just didn't work. But there's a basic play. So basic play number one, you can just sponsor some DLC. And that works easily for games which have seasonality. So games that have seasonal updates, there's always an opportunity for a brand to get involved there somewhere. So an always on live game, that's the obvious one. Other ways in are doing like classic media buys. So in a racing game or a football game where you've got out of home but in game, just doing a media buy and taking your standard out of home and whacking it in the game. Easy peasy, but also really not that effective, I don't believe. So whenever we look at a brief from a client, it's always going, right, where's the best fit for you? The talk that I give, I often come back to, I spend a bit of time talking about Animal Crossing, because so many brands did so many good things well in Animal Crossing because they understood the culture of the gaming platform. That's the first question that we look at when we figure out where they're going is, what's the culture of the gaming platform we're going into? So for Hellman's Mayonnaise, when they did their food bank island, if you took your spoiled turnips in Animal Crossing to their island, they then donated to a food bank. And that really ties back to their brand promise around getting rid of food wastage, which I like, great. They understood it. They did it.
Just for that one, how do you articulate what the culture of a platform is? Like, so for me personally, a culture is usually a set of behaviors based on a set of beliefs. So I might write down, you know, 3 to 5 beliefs that seem to be apparent in a culture, which could be an internal work culture. I'm not talking about gaming here. And then the 3 to 5 main behaviors that seem quite apparent in that culture. How do you document the culture? What's the culture of Animal Crossing?
Wholesome. Wholesome is like the main thing. It's wholesome, it's cutesy, and it's generous. The 3 examples I use for Animal Crossing are IKEA, KFC, and Hellman's. KFC, you just go and you can go and play hide and seek with Colonel Sanders. That's it. That's how wholesome it is. I just get to go and I play hide and seek with Colonel Sanders. And if you know the game, you kind of get it. Feels good. But if you were looking at let's look at something completely different. If you're looking at Elden Ring, You're right. Elden Ring is one of the biggest games of the year that didn't, I don't think, managed to break through into popular culture, but it's one of the biggest games of the year. And if anybody listening to this is a gamer of any kind, they would know what I'm talking about with Elden Ring. There was a guy playing it on Reddit who said his character was called Let Me Solo Her. And he basically would turn up to the hardest boss in the game. You could open the door in your game. He would step through it. The hardest boss in the game with no armor. You would stand back and he would beat the hardest boss in the game for you, which was amazing. And a couple of brands did a few interesting things with it because they just thought he was this amazing icon within games culture. Mm. But they knew that in Elden Ring, the subculture in Elden Ring was getting your build right, beating the hardest boss possible. Do you summon people in or not? They knew. You know, and the same with Call of Duty. People think about it. It's toxic. It's intense. It's sweaty. There are all these different verbs that sit around it and adjectives that sit around it where you go, right, does the brand feel right in there or not?
That makes sense. Every now and then I'll see hypothetical work, scam work or award entry work, but not award entry work as in it's been made, but maybe it's speculative for like Cannes Young Lions or something, right? And somebody who might know a little bit of gaming has put together this presentation and they're like recommending or saying they're going to do stuff that the gaming platform's never going to do. You know, like we're going to take over all of Fortnite and change all of the characters and all of the colors and make it black and white for a day. And you're like, that's never going to happen. And then they win the award. You're like, what? What are some of the ways that you see or have heard agency people get this stuff wrong?
I've got two examples and they're both Burger King and I'm sorry. So I saw there was a big thing a while back and I forget the name of the campaign, but basically the premise was Twitch streamers. I can send you the link to the case afterwards. Twitch streamers streaming. Burger King would drop into their chat and say something like, and would donate. You can donate in stream on Twitch, right? I would donate $2.39 and then a comment would be read out that said, $2.39, that's exactly the same price as a Tasty Whopper. You can buy one online at this link. And the streamer would see the $2 come in and say, oh, thanks, BK Bot, really appreciate it. Because you paid, you get to speak, then it's an ad. And the backlash from the community was incredible. I've got slides on this. I've talked about this case quite a lot because it was described as extremely low class. And I was like, that's such a burn. It's such a burn. Because fundamentally, Twitch streamers are there to make money, yeah, through streaming, but they also want to do proper brand partnerships. And coming in and taking over their stream for $2 was just felt icky. And I look at that and I go, there was not a single gamer on that brief. No way.
Sure.
Absolutely not.
Did the people only get $2.39 or were there other deals happening as well? And the $2.39 was just a way to engage in the actual stream itself. Like, you're getting $1,000 plus $2.39.
No. It was just $2.39. And the reason I know this was because the backlash was so fierce. I mean, it even made the BBC News because it was so intense. Everybody just pushed back and went, this is the worst thing anybody has done in gaming for a long time.
But do you think it sold more burgers? Because that was a question I wanted to ask, which is a question you'd have to think about all the time, measuring effectiveness. Maybe you do this stuff for the PR hit, and it doesn't matter how many people played hide and seek with Colonel Sanders or how many people actually saw the $2.39 in the stream. You get on BBC, boom, positive, negative. Maybe that doesn't matter. I'm so sure someone's got science on it. I see Burger King, I go buy Burger King. Job done.
I don't know. I'm a little anti that for obvious reasons. When I look at some of the case studies, I mean, they're scam, right? They're canned scams, right? You look at them and you go, they've just put this case study together and it's not really about the PR. It's probably about the views on the YouTube video. And if that YouTube video gets over 100K views or maybe over 500K views, then I get to send it to Cannes in a few months. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like that kind of shit.
Sure.
I don't really have time for it.
So how many games of hide and seek with Colonel Sanders is success?
I'm going to play a get out of jail free card on that one. And the reason why I'm going to do that is because Animal Crossing came out, I think, 3 weeks into the global lockdown. And for, I would say, tens of millions of people around the world, it was their escapism. And at a time when brands genuinely had no idea what to do, doing something in a place where people were in a wholesome way, I can kind of forgive that.
You know what I can't forgive these days is any game that has an unnecessarily long onboarding experience that teaches me how to earn and spend their digital currency. I'm like, I'm not doing this right now. I've been doing this for 15 years. And no, I'm going to go back to my Clash Royale clan. I know how to spend the money there. There's so much of it. Like, you know, Sims was great. It got really crazy with this sort of stuff. And at some point, those games can feel like they're literally never ending and always changing the goalposts. You're like, hang on, I earned the money for this thing. Now I'm angry. Do you play many of those games? Lots of digital currency.
I play them, but I don't purchase within them. So I play a bit of Warzone. I think Sims is about to go free to play actually in October. I'm sure I read that the past couple of weeks. I mean, that to me says it's free to play, great, and there's going to be in-game items to purchase, microtransactions and stuff.
Yeah, speed up opening of crates and things.
My main drug, Destiny 2, there's in-game microtransactions in there. I don't really use them that often. What else do I? That was Fall Guys. I don't really go in on the ones that really try and like extract cash from your wallet every time you open the game. It's like, no, we'll just keep those over there and maybe not install them and keep my kids away from them too.
When you're working with gaming, I'd see it largely as a subset of communications planning where you're working how to turn up who first, where, and how, and maybe a little bit of message, right? To what degree does it also involve, you mentioned the phrase earlier, creative strategy or account planning, where you're trying to work out, like you're trying to connect what you're doing to the bigger business problem, but wrestling with a bigger business problem before the campaign idea and then gaming. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I had a realization probably a few months in to the gig where our leadership team is 50% people who have been in games their whole lives and 50% people who are new into games. And games as a category is a relatively young industry, right? It's 40 years old. I think that's fair to say. And you've always been dealing with an engaged audience. You're not trying to build memory structures at a zero moment of truth on the shelf. If your game is good and you're scoring between 7 and 10 out of 10, I can take that box art, put it in a Facebook ad, and the thing will sell itself, right? It's a bit like that. I'm oversimplifying for the purpose of the conversation. When you look at that and you go, okay, so what about your audience? And then you'll get a brief that says, our audience insight slide from the client will say, our target audience are people that bought the game last time. Our secondary audience are people that buy games like this. And our tertiary audience is all gamers. And then we go next slide into and tell you about the game. I'm like, no, hang on a minute. Wait a second. What do we know about these people? Oh, that's all we know about them. I was like, okay. And so that journey going on both with my team, but also with some of my clients going, can we just spend maybe a couple of days just investigating who these people are a bit more versus this three-layered onion you've given me? And that's been fun and challenging at times, but the rewards have been really quite beneficial. We had one client, just some Facebook ads. And we're like, can we just apply some behavioral science to how we're putting this work together? And we saw a 400% increase on click-through rate. It is basic stuff, but it's basic stuff we've never thought to apply before because gamers just buy games. Where the population of gamers, in inverted commas, has just completely gone through an exponential rate of growth, my belief is that there is a whole bunch of money being left on the table to people who play games who aren't currently being serviced, who currently aren't being advertised to. We aren't finding new ways to speak to new gamers. We're using old ways to speak to the same gamers. And therefore, why are we wasting money on people who are going to buy the game anyway? And then you start getting into a bit juicier conversations around, oh, right, okay, then let's do something completely different.
You've touched on this briefly, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about it. How do you approach research? Are you doing months of in-depth research? Are you speaking to a few gamers here and there, mostly desk research? How do you approach it?
All of the above. So when I joined, my chief marketing officer, Alex, was setting up a research proposal with Yuki. So Yuki, UK Interactive Entertainment, they're the trade body for video games in the UK. And just looking at, right, what can we do to understand the gaming population better? Because it's changed post-COVID. It's definitely changed. One. Two, being plugged in at a senior level. So again, leaning on Yuki, but setting up and talking to senior players in this gaming space and saying, right, what have you seen change? What have you seen change? How are you feeling, your team's feeling? We've seen the rise of the indie scene has come up really, really strong. So if you go to any games conference recently, the indie scene that used to be like five computers in the corner is now like 70% of the whole conference. Now, there's a little bit of AAA sense taking a break and a few of the big players taking a break, but the fact that there's so much indie space there that is filled, I find fascinating. And then you've got your standards like YouGov reports, all the desk research stuff. News are a really good source. I lean on ISFE a lot, which is the European trade body for gaming. So yeah, it's a mixture. And looking at where possible outside of the realm of gaming, because gamers live normal lives. They don't live special gaming lives where only gaming data applies to them. It's like, oh, there's a recession. Maybe they won't be buying as many games. Okay, let's do that.
The indie scene or the indie world, what's its center of gravity? Is it Steam?
Predominantly, yes. I would have to say yes. But more and more, because of you've now got digital storefronts in all of the major platforms, a lot of games will come to Steam first, and then they might get pushed out onto PS5 by the digital store, or PlayStation by the digital store, or they'll just fall onto Game Pass. In fact, there's a publisher called Super Rare, and Super Rare take really popular Steam games and create hardware launches specifically for Nintendo Switch. And they're beautifully made, and the artwork's nice, and they sell out by tens of thousands because it's an opportunity to, A, play the game on Switch, but B, also have a cartridge because, you know, people like to have like things they can hold sometimes.
Do brands do anything with the indie games, or are they too small? Is the scale not there? Is it too hard to do business with them?
Umming and ahhing about that, because I think there's probably is an opportunity there. We're probably about a year away from it. I'm kind of moving the conversation a little bit, but we'll come back to this point. One of the things I always come back to is nobody took a selfie until Ellen DeGeneres did it at the Oscars, right? The Samsung sponsored selfie with all the popular Hollywood starlets in it. Before that day, you wouldn't catch anyone in the street stopping to take a picture of themselves. After that day, everybody was doing it.
Is this true? You know, selfie came from Australia, that word. So I'm assuming people were doing it. But what are you saying? They weren't doing it in public in front of other people?
I didn't see it as a globally accepted behavior. And maybe this me again, being British and being quite like, oh, no, I wouldn't do that. But when as soon as that happened at the Oscars, suddenly I saw it everywhere. And it might be the bit of me just going, oh, that happened. But for me, that was a real turning point. It was okay to do this thing. Gaming, I think, is going through that at the moment. Like, I literally, before I joined this call, the new Ed Sheeran music video is just him and Pokemon. And it's bloody great. It was a great music video. I was like, there is another cultural touchstone of gaming now being acceptable, now being an okay thing to do. And so as that becomes more and more acceptable as part of culture, because there's all this old baggage with gaming about toxicity and the reasons why boys are bad at school and all of the bad, non-true stuff. The indie scene, I think, is close to breakthrough on that. But there's a broader gaming acceptance piece that I think needs to happen, which I think is in the process of happening.
I've not seen data on this. I don't know if you have, but what are the top 3 to 5, roughly speaking, games that get the most money from brands?
I would easily say, this is off the top of my head, but the live gamers, right? So you're talking about Fortnite, who every single week have a different brand partnership in there. Roblox, because they're building stuff in there and there's a percentage taken off the top of that every time. And then outside of the two big hitters there, I would then look to things like PUBG, maybe, possibly FIFA, because some brands turn up in FIFA, like the Ted Lasso stuff they announced this past week, arriving in the next FIFA game. Amazing. I don't know how much money would have changed their hands there at all, but it's kind of like, it's the live games, the games that always keep refreshing and updating.
And now maybe the most important question of the interview. I have teenagers now, but at one point they were kids. When they were kids, I was working with Xbox. Xbox gave me a free Xbox. I used it a little bit and it was fun. And then I became very aware of the fact that gaming and my interest in hip hop didn't always suit the environment that we were creating at home in a very small apartment. And so I did not use Xbox for a long time. Now I am considering PlayStation or Xbox. Help me make the decision.
Oh my God. So I have to say PlayStation. They're a client. So I have to.
So you literally have to. Okay, fine.
No. So let me tell you my story. I was always Nintendo, pure. And I hated PlayStation when it first came out. I was a real gatekeeper. And looking back at myself, I regret those choices. It's like, oh, casuals. I don't want casual, cool people in this thing. Go away with your FIFA. Take it back down the pub. I played Nintendo and I was like, NES, Super NES, N64, GameCube. And then I think it was when I had the Wii, maybe. I fell down some stairs and I was laid up like a really damaged leg for a couple of weeks. And my friend lent me his Xbox.
Hang on, because you were playing on the Wii?
No. I think I might have been drunk. Me, in London, I was lent this Xbox and it completely blew my mind because it was like Burnout and Halo, this whole other world of games. I was like, oh my God, there's a whole other world of games I've not explored. And so I got an Xbox. And so I had an Xbox 360. At the time, the cohort I was part of was called the Wii 60 people. People that bought Nintendo and Xbox because they didn't like PlayStation. And then around when the PS4 was coming out, all of my Xbox friends were making the jump. So this is it. This is the machine. And I went and played one at an expo and was like, oh my God, this is really good. And moved with my friends. And then all my friends were like, you've got like three generations of games you've not played. And this thing is backwards compatible. And so I was like, wow, complete wow. And I still think PlayStation to me has inarguably the best single player offering, period. Like Sony are masters at publishing, developing, and looking after people that bring out single player games. In PlayStation 4's last year of being their lead console, so PS4 was out, PS4 Pro was out, it was the year before PS5 came out, they expected to come in under their numbers. They launched God of War and Spider-Man in that final year, and they had a bigger year than they'd ever had before because of those two games. Incredible. I can't not talk about Xbox because I think the work that Xbox has done to lower the barrier to entry for all gamers has to be applauded, whether that's Game Pass. Like, you can open a laptop, type in xbox.com/play, pay a quid to try Game Pass, or even just create an account and you can play Fortnite straight away and you can play anywhere on any screen. And I find that incredible. So it depends what you're doing and what your budget is and what you like. So you could, as a previous Xbox owner, you've got an Xbox account. You could go to xbox.com/play, log in with your old account, and you could be playing straight away.
Okay. I'm leaning towards the PlayStation.
Yes.
James, I really appreciate you being here. Thank you for sharing a little bit about your inner life with us in the first part of this and then talking about gaming in the second part of this. If people want to find out more about you, where are you most active on the internet?
I'm most active on Twitter. I'm Whatley Dude everywhere. So if you want to add me on PlayStation, I'm Whatley Dude. Add me on Xbox, I'm Whatley Dude. On Twitter, Whatley Dude. On Instagram, my account's there. I don't use it, but I'm also Whatley Dude.
I love it. And thank you for mentioning Sweathead, by the way. It's always weird when people mention that thing. I try not to be super promotional and self-serving because strategists don't like that. They're very cynical, but I am looking forward to your contribution to our conference in October, the Sweathead Do Together. People can find out about that at thesweatheaddotogether.com. Wanted to talk to you anyway, but also being able to bring you into the conference and talk to you about it all at the same time. There's a lot of us for each other right now. That's all I'm saying. But thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mark. I really enjoyed it.
Enjoy the rest of your day. Peace.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sweathead. If it's your first time here, please subscribe. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with a friend or leave a kind rating. For more information about our strategy classes, events, and books, visit www.sweathead.com. And yes, you can find us on Instagram at Sweathead.